Welcome, everyone, to these Goldster podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about healthy living. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome this summer's afternoon, rather damp where I am, to Goldster Inside Story at a different time, because we are travelling across the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Coast, where my guest heads up the Gift of Aging Unit at the Oregon Health and Science University. Not exactly that name, but you get my drift. She is a medical specialist in exactly what happens to us as we get older. In 2016, she co-authored the hugely successful Gift of Caring book and has now followed it up with The Gift of Aging, Growing Older with Purpose, Planning, and Positivity. She will explain how our bodies and our brains, although I think the brain is part of the body, but we'll find out about that, and how they age, and if we know what's likely to happen, how we can make aging a gift of new experiences well into our 80s, 90s, and hundreds. And pass our wisdom and mentoring onto those 60s or 70s youngsters. Her conclusion is that this third act of our lives can be exciting, meaningful, and fulfilling, and that even though elderly, we can all continue to play our part in making the world a better place. And above all that, my guest is a really fun person, so we've got a couple of quiz questions coming up. When does somebody become old? What age, if you're a geriatrician, which is what her title is what age do people become old? Put it in the chat, let us know, and let's see how close we are. And as you get to know my guest, who's sitting waiting patiently, how old is she? How far is she from being a geriatric herself? Yes, and we've chatted before, ask her anything you want. She lifts spirits and raises our learning curves. And welcome, Dr. Elizabeth Ekstrom, to Goldster Inside Story.
Thank you so much, Humphrey. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm not seeing people being very bold in the chat. So I think we need a few people to chime in and tell me what you think deserves being called old or being called an elder. And Humphrey's addition was, how old do you think I am? Which is very kind, because I don't think of myself as looking particularly young. So I'm glad he asked to add that question. Anyway, I'm Elizabeth Ekstrom. I'm Chief of Geriatrics at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm absolutely delighted to be on the program today with all of you and just to be able to share some of the tips and tools and stories about growing older and how we can really try to do that in a good way.
Well, that is fantastic. But then a geriatrician, is that like a pediatrician at the other end of life?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people have never even heard the term. And there was a kind of fun YouTube out there, I think that happened in the U.S., where everybody was asked, what is a geriatrician? And they came up with a million different answers, and it had nothing to do with being a doctor or taking care of older people. So it's a term that's not well known. But yes, it is like a pediatrician. So if you're a kid and you're going to the doctor, a lot of times you want that extra expertise. You want the specialist to see you, and that is the pediatrician. But you get into your 80s, 90s, and 100s, and there's nobody telling you you should have a specialist. Somebody who cares for people in those age ranges, and you just keep seeing your regular general practitioner. But we have a whole specialty in caring for older adults and caring for the things that happen to us as we age.
This is interesting. There is a group of things, and we're going to discuss them in more detail, that happen to us as we age. We haven't yet, Celia here has answered, and I'm going to have a little look at this. Geriatric is 75 plus. We're not going to say the answer yet. Let's have some more guesses or knowledges in there. You're not allowed to Google it, or you can, I don't care. And let us know. But then what about those between the wild adolescents, the young parents, the grumpy middle-aged men? Do they get a category?
You know, they don't, unfortunately. They're just the tweensters, I guess. You know, anyone who is in the normal age range just has a regular general practitioner or somebody who has internal medicine expertise. And it's there are a lot of people who think there should be more specialists in that age group. And, you know, interestingly, we consider ourselves real experts in chronic illnesses, taking care of people who have diabetes, who have strokes, who have all sorts of things go wrong with them. And the general practitioners do that very well for people in their 40s and 50s, because when you're younger, you all kind of look the same. And I'm not passing any judgment on this, but if you have two 40-year-olds in the hospital with a heart attack, you can probably care for them very similarly and they will get better very similarly. If you have two 85-year-olds in the hospital who have a heart attack, it can be extremely different. And I love the comment from Jean, who said that she's got friends who seems old in their 60s and others who don't seem old in their 80s. And that's exactly what this is. We have increased variability as we age, so that one 85-year-old does not look like another 85-year-old. And you need that extra expertise to think about how to take care of that person.
So if a 50-year-old wanted to have you as a consultant, would you be able to accept them and call them in? We haven't got that age yet, but now I want the guesses to come in, and we want you to guess Elizabeth's age as well. But 50-year-old, could you be termed a geriatric?
Only if you've got something that kind of qualifies as a geriatric condition. Let's say somebody's got really severe Parkinson's disease with dementia at age 50, which happens occasionally, then I would be more than happy to see you and take care of you. There's early onset Alzheimer's disease. There are a few things. If somebody's got ALS, for example, just a terrible debilitating disease that makes them old quickly and die young, I'm more than happy to see and help manage all of the complexities of those diseases. But for the most part, it's people who are quite a bit older than that.
Okay, I think you're not allowed to read out the chat, Elizabeth, because Jean Joyce thinks you're about 55. We're not going to say whether that's right or wrong. But just to categorize the other part of our competition, what you're saying, what we're asking for is the average age of a geriatric, the sort of normal age of your patients, as opposed to the rare age. And so, what is the normal age of a geriatric? Your book has got a heap of fascinating topics in it, and I want to go through as many as we can get to. But I want to start. You've got the sort of conditions and the heart and the diet and everything, but you have a section on the finances, and that struck me because it's not particularly if we have a stroke or a heart attack and suddenly we can't do that. Are you talking there about our brains slowing down and it's more difficult for us to understand our bank statements?
Absolutely. So one thing to consider if you're trying to think about your brain as you age is what's normal and what's not normal, okay? So when we're doing our finances, you know, we're sitting there, we have to be able to concentrate, we have to be able to track through a bunch of numbers. And as we're going through normal aging, some of the things that happen is our speed of processing slows down. So that ability to track through all of the numbers takes longer. That is a normal change with aging. A second normal change with aging is that we have harder time concentrating. So we're not as good at double tasking. Now, most of us aren't as good at double tasking when we're young as we think we are. And we should probably be paying attention to that even at a much younger age. But it turns out if we get distracted when we're older, we'll have a hard time getting back to a task. So for example, if you want to do your finances, you're going to want to give yourself a big enough chunk of time, and you're going to want to turn off your email, turn off your phone, get rid of the distraction so that you can simply concentrate on doing your finances. And if that's the case, you may be able to continue doing them until you're quite old. But some people have to stop doing them, and it's just no longer possible. And that's when you start to swing into actually having some cognitive impairment, which is that your executive function declines. So executive function is how we plan, how we, you know, like plan a trip and then make sure that we've got all the hotels sorted out, we've got all of our train tickets sorted out, all of our plane tickets sorted out, and we can actually execute the trip and everything will be in place and taken care of. That is executive function. Driving to a new place, understanding, you know, how to navigate traffic, those things are all executive function. That shouldn't necessarily decline as we grow older. We might need more time to do those tasks. We might need less distraction. You can't drive with the radio on, or you can't drive with a passenger speaking with you. But we shouldn't have reduced executive function. But sometimes we do. And having reduced executive function is a change that can lead to dementia. And that's something we should be watching.
And what age roughly would that take that I have to spend more time doing my bank statements, like I can't be doing it now whilst I'm talking to you and that sort of thing?
Yeah. So for a lot of people, that kind of starts around 75 or so, 75 to 80, where you have to start, you know, kind of really paying attention to giving yourself that extra flexibility. It's a notion of adaptability. You know, we just have to make these changes based on what we're noticing in ourselves. And rather than denying that we're having these changes, we have to kind of confront them and say, well, I'm just not quite as good. I made mistakes. I did my taxes this year because I was rushing through it.
And this is exactly the same that if you're 75, you can't run a 4-minute mile. So you just realize that your body is what we know what is happening in our physical body, or more, what's actually happening in your brain when it slows. Is there something that accessible that you can tell us about that?
Yeah. So it's this notion, and this is part of the book as well. And I love this. I got this from a colleague of mine, Emily Morgan, but this notion of last in, first out, the pieces of our brain that develop the latest when we're teenagers and young adults are also the ones that seem to deteriorate first. And a lot of it's in our frontal lobes. And it's the area of the brain where we are able to have good judgment. We've all interacted with young adults and we say, well, bad judgment comes from good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment, right? I love that quote.
When your failures are your successes. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But as we get older, we have a lessening of some of those pieces of the frontal lobe that help with judgment and help with planning, help with executive function. And it's some of it is a normal part of aging, like I described, but then some of it is definitely not normal. And so, you know, a big part of the book is really trying to sort out, how can you prevent that? What can you do to make sure that you're not one of the people who has cognitive decline as you grow older? And a lot of people think it's inevitable. A lot of people think getting dementia is just, just going to happen when they get older. But it's not. It's absolutely not inevitable.
And so in a nutshell, and I'm not going to, I want everybody to buy Elizabeth's book. And I think that the Goldster is going to send a copy of Elizabeth to the people that get the answers right about how old is an average geriatric and how old is Elizabeth. And I've forgotten the answers to both. But give me in a nutshell what we can do cognitively, like crosswords or something, and what we can do diet and whatever to keep our brains healthy.
Yeah. Well, it's not a super nutshell, but I'll give you the basics.
And
first of all, it starts the day we're born. Exactly. So there are interesting studies that look at biomarkers, blood levels, things in people who are as young as 3 that help predict dementia at age 80. So it really starts, even in placenta, it starts with youth. And so really getting to the highest level of education is the first thing that you want to do. You want to attain the highest level of education possible. And if you only made it through high school or maybe, college early on, and you want to go back and get some more schooling, that's a great idea. Get your highest possible level of education. But then things like diet and exercise can start at a very young age as well. And so exercise, there are studies showing that if you're a woman and you're 30 and you do weight training, you will have less dementia when you're old.
Okay, so exercise. But if you are, you go through life normally and then you hit your 60 or 70 or something, and you suddenly start reading about all this stuff, what should you do then? You should start the exercise and you should start the good eating and stop the drinking and all the rest of it.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. So Absolutely. So if you're already 60, 70, 80, please don't think you're all is lost. You know, so exercise and Tai Chi is something that I study a lot and do a lot. I've done some randomized trials on the cognitive effects of Tai Chi and found that if you do Tai Chi regularly, you will have improved cognition, which I've heard your audience does a lot of Tai Chi.
Andy is the most, I think still, Joe can correct me if I'm wrong, our most favored tutor, as it were, with his Tai Chi classes. But tell us more about Tai Chi. The goals to people doing the right thing.
Absolutely. So, so obviously you've got the smartest audience in the world. So Tai Chi does improve brain function. It also reduces depression, which of course is linked to brain function. It improves sleep. Again, strong links to brain function with sleep. It improves blood pressure, all sorts of health conditions that Tai Chi makes better. So again, starting it early and continuing it through old age, we have 98-year-olds who do Tai Chi on a regular basis. There's no age where you have to stop doing Tai Chi.
Now, I don't want to pit one against the other, but Tai Chi is better than going to the gym or doing yoga or Pilates and all the rest of it because it's sort of what, moving things in a different way?
Yeah. So Tai Chi is really great because it's called dual activity. It's got a mind component and a body component. You know, you have to remember the Tai Chi moves and it's meditative. So it's got that mind element, but then you're also doing the moves and you're strengthening your core and you're improving your quad strength and all of those things that make you more physically fit, which is really
good.
Yeah. So Tai Chi is one of the good things, but for exercise, I'd really recommend a combination of Tai Chi strength training and aerobics. You know, aerobic exercise is great for your heart and your lungs. So you want to do a brisk walk or a bike ride or, you know, a run at least 30 minutes a day. And then you want to do weight training, which could be Pilates. It could be lifting weights. It could be some of the more vigorous forms of yoga at least 2 to 3 days per week. And then you want to do Tai Chi at least 2 to 3 days per week. So it's really...
And because you're in that elderly age range, you have to spend more time doing these exercises and thinking about it than you would when you're climbing the career pole and running from meeting to meeting on a 9-to-5 job or whatever, raising a family and all that thing. Is that right? You actually have to spend more time on it.
Just think of it as your new job. And it,
new job, right. Okay.
Probably want to think about, you know, 60 to 90 minutes a day of regular exercise and just put it in, you know, walk with a friend and then go to your Tai Chi class and just... You know, have that be part of your day. And people just tell me, oh, I'm so busy. I don't have time for any of this. And I say, well, do you want to be in a wheelchair and, you know, be busy? Or do you want to be vibrant and active and, you know, accomplishing things in a much more efficient way? So it's really taking the time to do the exercise.
Okay. We have some guesses in now. Can you see those, can't you, Elizabeth? Is anybody right? Tell us what our audience is saying about you.
Well, so I'm actually 58, almost 59. So somebody got it just right. I'm a baby boomer. I'll turn 60 next year at the tail end of the baby boomer era. And so technically geriatrics is 65. So I don't know how many books you're going to have to give out here, Humphrey. I guess people have to get both numbers right, huh?
Let's go down this. So Jean Joyce thinks you're about 55, which isn't right. Celia thinks you're 64, which
is a little on the old side, but that's okay.
A little on the old side. Jean Joyce, 85 for geriatric. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah. So in the U.S., Medicare starts at 65, and technically people can be considered geriatric at 65. But on average, only about 2-4% of people need a geriatrician when they're 65. It's really by the time you're 85 or so that everyone deserves to have the additional expertise and specialized care of a geriatrician.
Right. So 85, I think, is the Jim Joyce is the winner there. So we're going to be Anne says 58.
Yes.
That's it. We hit that on the head there, 58. And geriatric 65 is all right. Patricia, I'm fit and happy because of gold, sir. Thank you, Patricia. This is on our local news last night, 104. This is Elaine. They were remarkable, both of them laughing, lively, and alert and articulate. And I would have put them as around 80-year-olds if they asked. Yes.
Yeah, one of the people in our book is now 102, and she came to one of our book readings. And so we kind of asked the audience, how old do you think she is? They didn't know which of the people in the book she was at the time. And people were saying 88, 84, 82, and she was laughing. And when she finally said she was 102, everybody couldn't believe it.
And Celia, who thought it was 65, oh my God, I'm a geriatric. Phew, what a relief. I'm not, because it's actually 85. Now, if Joe is around, we must. Who got your age right? We must get this.
Anne
got the age right, and Jean Joyce got geriatric right. So Jean Joyce and Anne, we'll send your addresses in to Joe, and or whatever, and you will get a book. Elizabeth's wonderful book. And I want to get on to this next element that you have two words in there. One is that no one really wants to be elderly, but people want the wisdom, or people want to be elders where they can give advice and that. Is this our society that doesn't like elders, or what is it? What do you give us an idea what you're talking about there?
Yeah, so language is really important when you're thinking about older people, and the word when you say elderly, you kind of denote frailty, decline, being at the end of life, not having anything left to offer. And nobody wants that. We do have things to offer no matter what stage we are in life. But instead, we think of wise elders, from many of the tribal perspective and many of the cultures around the world, the elders are the most respected people in that culture. And it's just kind of our very fast-paced, youthful looking, wanting, desiring, in the US, in Europe, places like that, where we've kind of gotten away from this and we've started to fear growing older. We fear what might happen to us rather than being able to appreciate and relish the things that we will have as an older person. So being an elder, has wisdom attached to it. It has experience. It has joy. It has value. If you look at studies about happiness, you find that older people are the happiest people in the world. And, that goes exactly against our notion of frailty and decline, doesn't it? But older people have the ability. It's like the introduction to our book where Neil Maine, who was 85 when he wrote this, said, as you grow older, you climb higher on the mountain and you can see things with more perspective and you see more beauty and you see more joy in the world. And that is the gift of aging. And that is what is so powerful about having that experience and having that age behind us. And we can be a real elder.
So the elder is the gift. And we in the West, whereas in Japan and China and as you said, the tribal communities, they will go to the elders for general advice, but they don't go to them to sort of fix a computer in the car. That's done by the younger generation. So given that this is not a political show at all, but is Trump or Biden seen as elders, or are they seen as something else altogether?
Oh, I cannot answer that question.
Well, but it's not about them themselves. It's really about an elder is, I think what I'm saying is that nowadays you can see somebody looking at elder, oh, he doesn't know TikTok, or he doesn't know how to sort of drive an electric car, so therefore he's useless type of thing. Whereas there is a whole raft of stuff that they do know, that is information or wisdom that's not imparted to other people.
Right. And so people like that who have been in the workplace for a long time, who have had a lot of interaction with a lot of people over the years, they have language skills that have developed to a great extent. I'm not going to necessarily point out the leaders of the US here because I'm not sure they're good examples, but as you get older, you continue to develop your language skills and you continue to develop your ability to experience things and be able to relate to other people. And we, as we get older, one of the interesting things is we tend to rely on statistics and numbers less, and we rely on experience and emotions more. So instead of saying, oh, you've got a 40% chance of having a cure with this cancer chemotherapy, you have to say, well, you know, probably less than half of people are going to actually get better from this treatment. Is this treatment really valuable for me? So you have to kind of take out numbers and add in the value side of things. And it's a really fascinating change and adaptation that we have as we age. But it's really important to recognize that and notice that and be able to adapt to how our brains are changing and how our thinking is changing.
You have a section called A Goal Higher Than Joy. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's one of my favorite stories. Rabbi Josh Stamper, here in Portland, Oregon, was still teaching at age 97. He, in fact, not just teaching in Portland or the U.S., but he was still broadcasting to Israel and doing teaching that way. So he just remained very purposeful. And he said that, you know, you're not looking for joy for yourself. If you're looking for joy for yourself, it's going to be a shallow joy. It's going to be short-lived. But if you can bring joy to others, if you can bring purpose to others, find others around you that you can make their lives better and help them have more meaning in life, then the joy will come.
Okay, so it's giving back, really, isn't it? It's this whole thing about being an elder and giving and people. And then you have open and determined mindset, open and determined.
Yeah, so that speaks to the notion of adaptability. So, you know, a lot of us are kind of like, oh, I'm going to just keep doing what I've been doing. I'm going to maintain my, you know, I'm going to maintain my running schedule. I'm going to maintain my heavy work schedule. I'm not going to let the changes of aging affect me. And, you know, everybody has that attitude for a while. And, you know, for a while you can make it work. You can just, you know, work harder and spend longer days and push things harder in, you know, 60s and maybe 70s. But really the ability to age well means that you can really understand your own body and make the adaptations that you need to make. So that open mindset is the ability to say, wow, I can't run anymore, but I can still walk. You know, I had an older friend, colleague, wonderful person who started running marathons at age, I don't know, 40 or something, pretty young. And he would run a marathon every year. And he was still doing this at 84. And so he found out that, you know, he couldn't run it anymore. He had to adapt and walk instead of running. And it took quite a bit longer. And he would do it on a track instead of on a beautiful trail in the middle of nowhere. And so you have to make these adaptations and you have to be able to remember what you love to do and then think about, now, how could I do something similar that I can still do when I'm 80 or 90 or 100. And so, and that's really that adaptability side of things.
We talked to 85 is the average age. So when when do people retire? Say 65-ish, you know, or 60-ish, you're starting to think about this thing. When does your body start to, I don't know, change? When do you start to get these conditions that like arthritis or whatever?
Yeah. So it's different for everyone. And, you know, some of it is our lifestyle. I think that, you know, somebody mentioned the 104-year-olds, chances are they've been eating a pretty healthy diet and exercising their whole life, or maybe not. Some people are just lucky. It's genetic, right? But if you are eating, so the Mediterranean diet is the diet that has the best benefits for growing older. And I, you know, recommend starting that as a kid. But, you know, starting it at whatever age you're at, when I've traveled to Britain, I'll confess I didn't necessarily see the Mediterranean diet as the primary diet people were eating there all the time. So, you know, all the fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, lentils, beans, all of those kinds of things. So really trying to start that at a young age is so important. And the exercise we've already talked about, getting enough sleep, not taking too many risky medications, those kinds of things. You can look great in your 80s and 90s. I mean, I had a lady who got hit by a snowboarder skiing and broke four ribs. And guess how old she was? Now I'm going to make you guess. How old do you think she was on the slopes when she got hit by this snowboarder?
in her 80s?
92.
What?
Yeah, so she was... Okay. So she,
and she broke four ribs at 92.
Four ribs, yeah, and had to go to the hospital. And then, so she came to see me, she came to see me regularly, and she said, I think it's probably time I stopped skiing. And I said, well, okay, that's perfectly fine. This was a pretty traumatic accident. I could perfectly understand that. And then, that was in like June or something. And then December or January comes around and she comes back in and she says, Elizabeth, I think I'm ready to try skiing again. What do you think? Can I get out back on the ski slopes? And I was like, well, just have somebody with you so they can make sure there aren't any more snowboarders that are going to hit you. But for lifestyle choices can make you frail and elderly at 62, or you could have bad luck. You could have a bad form of cancer. You could have, diabetes, youth onset diabetes. And people like that could be 55 or 50, and they have all of the features of geriatrics, which if you just kind of thinking about that, it's cognitive problems that we've already talked about a little bit. It's functional problems, not being able to take care of yourself, not being able to bathe yourself, dress yourself, having incontinence or losing your urine and getting wet. All of those features kind of could put you into a geriatric category at various ages. But a lot of it is under our own control.
So by the time we are 80 or something, and please, audience, jump in and correct me and tell me I'm wrong or the question's stupid or whatever, we would have a number of conditions that would tell us that we're old. We wouldn't feel like we were 35 anymore.
Yeah. So the percentage of people who actually need a geriatrician at age 65 is probably 2-4%, which is why I say that age range, you really don't need it. By 75, probably more like 10-15% of people have a condition that would best benefit from a geriatrician. And then by 85, it's at least 50% that have something that has happened to them, whether it be a medical condition or, some cognitive decline or something like that. So that's why 85 has kind of hit that target. But, like I said, I've got 102, and I mean, we had a 106-year-old who really didn't have anything wrong with her. She's still, going to the grocery store and shopping for people who were homebound. That was her volunteer activity. Now, she wasn't driving the food to their homes, right? She was doing the shopping and then handing it off to some younger person who would drive it out to those homes. But she was 106.
Talking to you, it's really interesting because most of us that go and see a doctor nowadays is for something specific. So you might get a statin or you might get a physio exercise or something like that. But this conversation is like talking to sort of a therapist in a way that knows the holistic thing. And then you could hone in on a piece of arthritis or a piece of depression or something like that.
Absolutely. So I have patients who come to see me and, we talk about Tai Chi, we talk about the Mediterranean diet, we talk about sleep and having social engagement. And at the end of the visit, they say, wait a minute, you didn't talk about my heart failure or diabetes or arthritis or anything. And I say, well, if you do all the things we talked about, those, they're going to go away. I mean, I've had patients who came to me when they were on like 18 pills and we got them down to maybe 2 or 3 just by changing their diet, healthy eating, all of the great things that that you can do to improve your health.
So it was the sort of mainstream medical doctors that said, right, prescribe the pill and do it like that. And they come to you and you say, no, non-pharmaceutical intervention here. This is what we're going to do. And you get that. And just so we got a little bit of good news for everybody here is that Andy is going to join us in about 5 minutes, and I want him to practice some Tai Chi moves with you for a few minutes there, just to give us a bit of fun and have a discussion about Tai Chi. But before we do that, killing us quietly, why social isolation is as bad for us as smoking.
Yeah, yeah. So alone, you in the UK, you're my hero on this account because you have a minister for loneliness. You have somebody who's in the government. You do. Somebody in the government is specifically assigned to thinking about loneliness in older adults and what to do about it. And you have a loneliness awareness week. And the Ministry of Loneliness gives out grants to local communities to to try to help find ways to reduce loneliness in the community. I mean, it's fabulous. I love it.
You don't have that in Oregon. Or are you the minister for loneliness? And
it might be me, right? I keep talking to my state officials and saying, we need something like this. But loneliness and social isolation aren't quite the same thing. You can be lonely but not socially isolated, or you can be socially isolated and not feel lonely. But they're both bad for you. They tend to lead to more depression, which of course leads to declining cognition as well as increased mortality. But they also, there are people who are socially isolated will have more heart disease, more mental health problems, a lot of things that increase their mortality. And that's why we say being socially isolated is like smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's really bad for your health.
It's bad for your mental health more than physical, isn't it?
But both, at least increased problems with physical health as well. So, and, I don't know if we have a clear sense of why. It might be maybe because, you're not as active, you're not exercising as much. If you have a friend, you can go for a walk with them. You can do things together with a friend to stay more active, even just going out to visit people forces you to be more active. Whereas when you're socially isolated, you might not be getting that same level of activity, but it also slows your cognition. So, if you're not engaging, if you're not putting yourself out there, you're more likely to have, some decline in cognition. And then, of course, it's a vicious cycle where a decline in cognition leads to staying home more, which leads to more decline in cognition. And you can just kind of cycle down. But people who are socially isolated also have less self-esteem. They have less kind of sense of self and less. They're more timid about going out into society and trying new things. So, if you're finding, we all found ourselves socially isolated the last few years, right? But if you're having trouble getting out of that, I'd say, just go volunteer at a local historical society or something that you might enjoy to really just try to get back into the swing of being with people and doing things. And if your cognition if it feels to you like your cognition isn't as good, just get out there and try it and your cognition will get better. So it's a good way to make your brain sharp.
So, and we have covered this over a number of conversations in Goldstone, but that time, and I've had it myself where I've got to go to a reception or something like that where there's going to be a sea of people that I don't know who will ignore me. And I'm sort of about to walk in the room and I say, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. What do you do just to get across the threshold to the volunteer group or to the whatever?
Yeah. Well, so that crowded room that's just mind-boggling for most of us, right? And when we're 20 or 30, we're fine with it because we love meeting new people. But it's completely normal to feel just so timid and reticent to enter that room, especially when there are a lot of people in it that we don't know. So, before you go in or before you go to your first volunteer day, you can just say to yourself, okay, I don't expect anything of myself. Like I'm not going to shine. I'm not going to become the comic of this group, but I'm going to connect with one person. Give yourself a really small thing. And maybe there's somebody who's also kind of standing alone by the window or something. I'm going to go, that person looks really friendly. I'm just going to go talk with them. And that's the only expectation I'm going to have of myself. Or, in this volunteer role, I'm not going to shine. I don't expect myself to, if I'm going to be a docent at the art museum, I don't expect myself to have lots of erudite explanations about this artwork. I'm just going to be able to say, hello, I hope you're enjoying the museum. Just start very simply. And you will find that as you do it, as you get into it, you are able to do more and more and more. And so I think it is just a matter of getting over that hurdle and setting yourself a really tiny realistic goal of one person or one little.
That's some achievable goal when to go in and don't overstay and just sort of meet that one person and go. I saw that Andy is with us now. Andy, I don't know if you're here to meet Elizabeth. If not, we have some wonderful Andy, how very good to see you. Unmute yourself, meet Elizabeth.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Andy. It's wonderful to meet you.
I love to meet you, Elizabeth.
I hear you're the Tai Chi person who's changed the world of Britain to become a very Everybody's now doing Tai Chi. I actually was in Cambridge during medical school many, many years ago, and there was no such thing as Tai Chi back then. So I'm glad that you have revolutionized the culture to really include Tai Chi, and I'm grateful that you're doing that. I was telling people, of course, it cuts your risk of falling in half. That's one of its biggest benefits. And falling, you know, for people in the US, and I think this is true in the UK as well, falling is the number one reason that people get put into a nursing home. And so, lose their independence. So if you can do Tai Chi and start falling and stop falling, that is your best way to remain independent in your own home. But it also improves memory, cognition, reduces problems with sleep, reduces depression, reduces pain, just has so many benefits. So I'm super grateful that you're doing this, and really glad that you've got the Goldster audience turned on to Tai Chi.
Thanks, Peter.
Andy, let us know what you think. Elizabeth is coming to us from Portland, Oregon, in case, and she is the head of the, I call it the Gift of Aging Unit at the local university. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Humphrey, and thank you, Elizabeth, for calling me in. And hello, everyone. My name is Andy, in case you haven't come across me through Goldster. And sorry to kind of hijacked this kind of conversation. And Elizabeth summarized it very, very well. It has a lot of benefit of how people stop falling, because it's a very good device for training your balance, and as well as we're constantly moving. It's a moving it's a meditation in movement, how I would describe it. So it's kind of bring yourself in the zone, and where nothing really matter, it's just you and yourself, and be in the moment.
So sort of mindfulness plus, I keep doing this. Could you show us, the two of you, could you do a move together just to sort of show me how it works? And then I'll come and join your class, Andy.
You didn't know. So I'm sure you would know this move. Shall we do the cloud hands? Shall we? Let's do cloud hands together.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. And Patricia doing it as well with us. Like, everyone, please join in. Yes. This kind of a lot of member is one of our favorite moves in the Tai Chi community, which is very mesmerizing. And when you imagine your hands are like the cloud that floating in front of you, and you just forget every bit of worry in your life.
Yes. So
I was watching the screen trans, because everybody, I think amongst our audience, there must be many of your people that can you see them there, Andy? People that you know?
I can kind of go through them. Yeah, I saw a few people that has been to my class this morning. Diane has been in my coaching class a couple of hours ago. Yeah, I saw some familiar names.
Oh, they're brilliant. Well, thanks so much for joining in. I mean, it was just fantastic seeing that, because you knew exactly what Andy was talking about. And so I think that Jane Andrews says, yes, I've been with Andy since lockdown.
Andy,
lovely to see you on screen, Jay.
And Andy, if I could add one more minute, I don't know if you know this approach called sticky hands for Tai Chi. Is that familiar to you? So this is another super cool thing. So when we have patients who have dementia or are very frail for other reasons, it's hard for them to do regular Tai Chi anymore, but they can do sticky hands Tai Chi, where you, as the younger person of the Tai Chi instructor, you put your hands on theirs, and then you walk them through some of these various movements with your hands sticking to their hands. And we've shown that for people who have dementia, like doing Tai Chi with sticky hands approach helps to reduce some of their behaviors and some of the distress that they have with their dementia and things like that. So it's a really powerful thing, even for people who are not healthy at all anymore. It's truly remarkable. And Andy, thank you so much for being on. It was just such a pleasure to meet you.
Well, and thanks for dropping in, Andy. And what I'm going to put your classes in touch with Elizabeth. So if anybody you come across is in our time zone or has some, you know, insomnia or something in Portland, you can lock them into Andy's class.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Andy. That was absolutely brilliant. We have got a lot of things that I have to go back. That Tracy Crouch is the Minister for Loneliness. Who knew that? Jean Joyce, who is the winner of one of your books. I look forward to reading it. Thanks. I'll be 77 this month and doing everything I can to keep aging at bay. And from this conversation, I know we're mentioning Tai Chi. It seems that to lock into something like that, that you can do in a routine everyday way, then everything will come from it, I presume. If you're enjoying your Tai Chi, you're not going to drink a bottle of whiskey a day, and you're not going to smoke 60 cigarettes a day and all the rest of it.
And you'll probably be able to get off 5 medications that were making you feel tired and having muscle weakness and things like that. So it's a truly valuable. And I have to laugh a little bit. There was a question in the chat about avoiding toxic relatives.
Yes. So I'm sorry. Yeah.
take your most toxic relative and invite them to a Tai Chi class with you. And it won't be long before the two of you are getting along just fine.
but do you, I mean, that's one, but how does one avoid toxic relatives? People that, you know, family, friends that you, yeah.
Well, certainly in my family, we just know we can't talk politics because the whole place would blow up. So, you know, stay on subjects that are relatively safe. But, you know, exercise and diet are super, you know, if you're dreading having Thanksgiving with your toxic relatives, but you know you have to go, rather than just, you know, going and bringing the apple pie, why don't you go and, you know, have people work together to chop up a salad and make a lovely kale salad for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, get those toxic relatives involved in doing something healthy. And that is a great way to just kind of overcome that. It, number one, gives you something to talk about and do, because who knows how to chop vegetables these days? And, you know, you can.
So again, it's about socializing, doing things, and giving, I guess, because you're chopping the vegetables for somebody or for a reason. Yes. Elaine has just come up with an interesting one, but there was one with Jean Joyce. Yes, after losing my husband, going out alone and traveling alone, going out alone and was the most difficult thing to do. Tip to get over that, because that's an inevitability in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, one of the hard parts about growing older is losing people who are close to you and having to grapple with that grief. But most people kind of ignore it. They're just taking that person and trying to be with them and be present while they're here. But in reality, we actually probably do need to start planning for what's going to happen when they're gone. For example, we need to learn the finances. If our husband's already done always done the finances, but now his health is frail and we expect that he's going to die soon. Number one, we have to say, wow, I expect that my husband's going to die soon, because a lot of us try to push that aside or not admit it. But, you know, we have to learn the finances, right? We have to have him teach us everything he knows before he dies. And similarly, you want to say, wow, I'm dedicating myself to my husband 100% right now. But I also have to understand that sometime soon, I'm going to need to be able to get out and drive myself. And I'm going to need to get out and make sure that I have my own friends. And so you have to kind of foster those things even while you're going through the caregiving experience. And be able to keep a piece of yourself, because if you lost all of yourself, you're just going to be stuck at home and you're not going to be driving and you're not going to have any friends left because you lost them all while you were caregiving. And we do this because we think because we want to, you know, we have to. That's our job as the caregiver, but we need to maintain, you know, a little bit of our own joy and a little bit of our own sense of person, so that when we lose those very special people,
you're not completely ripped down. And Elaine's got a very uplifting one here. I completed a PhD just before I was 70. Tell us the topic, Elaine. I don't say this to boast, but reiterate that we are capable of much more than we realize. And I know 4 or 5 70-plus people doing the same thing. So this is a different part of our brain? Because that's sort of working.
I keep saying I want to go back and do a PhD in piano. When I was young, I was debating whether I wanted to be a doctor or a professional pianist. And I think just financial-wise, it was really a good idea to become a doctor because I'm not that good at piano. But you know, it sure would be fun to go back and do a PhD.
And what part? You can't just do a PhD in piano. What would the title of the PhD be?
Wow, you're asking a difficult question. Well, you know, quote, I was a math major, and I've always kind of been into evidence-based medicine and, you know, statistics and making sure that randomized trials are completed correctly. So I would probably do it in music theory and how math relates to music. And I mean, because music is math, right?
Math relates to music, how those numbers and equations actually make a symphony.
Fifths, you know, the major chords, minor chords, that's all completely mathematically based. So I think I would kind of tie in some of that music theory. And 17th century French and British history. That is
This is Elaine, yes. 17th century French, British history. I still find brilliant stuff. So we are going to bring on some 17th century French and history authors, Elaine, for an inside story for you to quiz them and rip them apart. Or Maria. Positive mental health issue and sense of gratitude. This is what we've been talking about, to equip people with resilience and the capacity to cope with life's challenges. A great session. Yes, it has been a great session. Celia, I was widowed 4 years ago. I was already able to do everything needed to keep my home going and live independently. However, I have a sister-in-law who was unable to cope and her health declined rapidly. This is what you just said, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And it's so much of it is about ourselves. We have to find that inner resilience and having joy. You know, just every day, wake up and say thank you. That our 106-year-old wakes up every day and says thank you for one more day. And just being able, even in the toughest times, being able to find some joy in that day. If you just lost somebody, it's just so painful and difficult to go through. But you can still take joy in a really good cup of tea. And, you know, those little bits of joy are what gets you through and builds your resilience. And that's so incredibly important.
You know, I love being surprised about the conversations that we have here, but I was expecting to talk about sort of bone density and blood pressure and things. And we're actually talking about life, aren't we? Jean Joyce, a tip top for everyone is to understand your household finances. A top tip, I said tip top. There is one session there that I thought was really interesting, and I took advice from you, actually. The problem of pain in older adults, what can you do about it? Don't give in to it. Just give us a line on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are so many people who think that pain is inevitable with growing older, and yes, we do tend to have more aches and pains. But and I think a lot of doctors write it off. And so the worst thing you can do is go to the doctor and say, I've got pain in my hands or I've got pain in my back. And they'll say, oh, well, you're 89. Of course, you're going to have pain in your hands or your back. And just saying, oh, okay, no, don't do that. Say, but wait a minute, what can I do about it? And talk about, you know, if there's some topical gel you could use, or if you need some physical therapy, or use a heating pad, or, you know, do Tai Chi, you know, do an exercise program. Because even though we are, you know, our bodies have changes, we might have more arthritis in our joints. You know, if your muscles are very, very strong and you have good flexibility, arthritis pain diminishes greatly because now the muscles are doing the work and the joints don't have to do the work. So arthritis pain can just, you know, go away practically when you've got super strong muscles. So getting out there and getting strong and doing all of the things that you can do to help reduce the pain can make a big difference and give you a much more positive attitude about that pain.
So just the action of that, if you've got an aching shoulder or an elbow, you go to a physiotherapist, the physiotherapist will give you the exercises to do, and that builds the muscles to stop the pain.
Right, but you have to do the exercises.
You have to do them, yes.
Every day for the rest of your life.
Suri, does philosophy also relate to music and mathematics?
Oh,
well, you're a bit of a philosopher, aren't you, Elizabeth?
You know, I think, Suri, maybe you or somebody else in the audience would have a better answer to that than I do. I'm sure it does. I think of philosophy and meditation and, you know, writing, just creative writing as being the, as really being this creative outlet that we all need. It does help build resilience. It allows us to, it allows us to learn new strengths that we didn't know that we had. But I'm not sure I can tie that back to math.
Can you wait there for a couple of seconds whilst I tell our wonderful audience what's coming up next? And then we're going to get some cutting, insightful answers from you to wrap up. But next week, August the 8th, Lucinda, Purpose, Passion, and Grit with Nancy Chernin, an award-winning educator and children's book author based in North Texas. We are going across the Atlantic at the moment. August 10th, Lucinda is with Anna Kale, an arts and culture writer who specializes in classic film and television. She's done something on Diana Dawes, I think, and Little White Lies and film stories. That'll be fascinating. Lucinda, again, August 11th. What am I doing all next week? I must have been fired. With Dr. G, Sean Wensley is an award-winning vet, lifelong naturalist, and his book, Through a Vet's Eyes. Lucinda is with Jared Chapman, The Power of Yoga for Men. Yoga or Tai Chi, Elizabeth, which one do you think? No, I won't.
Interestingly, Tai Chi has been studied a lot more for older people, and yoga doesn't have as strong health outcomes as Tai Chi does. It's also sometimes a little harder to do because it's just harder to do a downward dog, for example, when you're very old, but everyone can do Tai Chi until the day they die. So I'm going to stick with Tai Chi.
Okay. And I have to ask you, Tai Chi or Pilates?
Tai Chi. Pilates doesn't. So Tai Chi increases your kind of your rotational support. You can feel stable along a greater range of space, like a bigger circle. Whereas with Pilates, you're mostly on machines and you're doing things that are, it's not your force. It's the force of the machines kind of pushing against you. So it's not building some of the same things. Pilates is fine for that strength training that you also need to do. But I think if you're going to choose one thing to get started with, I would choose Tai Chi.
Okay. I mean, I'm sort of converted to it, but August the 18th, I've never interrupted this before in such a way. August the 18th, Dr. Elizabeth Cambridge, Dr. Nicholas Cambridge, there we go. Bleak Health, The Medical History of Charles Dickens and His Family, that's with Lucinda. August 24th, I am with Harry Bucknell. He's an adventurer, an author, and a walker. He's just done thousands of miles walking around the United Kingdom and done a great book called A Road for All Seasons. And my book of the month, August 25th, after stiff Democratic competition amongst Goldstone members, The Bullet That Missed by Richard Osman. That's about people in an old people's home becoming detectives. And the runner-up to that at the end of December, that's September 29th, is Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. And November 24th, my instinct is to go for Jonathan Livingston Seagull. But it's early days, and if anybody wants anything else, let us know, and we'll run a poll on it. Which one would you take between Heart of Darkness and Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Elizabeth, if you know both those books?
Absolutely. I mean, how many of your audience is totally woo-woo? You should do that, Saul, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, but Heart of Darkness will teach you so much about resilience and how to think about challenging times and how to build that resilience. So I'm probably going to have to go with Heart of Darkness, even though it's much harder to read.
Oh, Elaine loves Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Jennifer, thank you for a wonderful session. They're coming in quicker than I can. Patricia Reese's, I'll go back to Andy Tai Chi's now. And Celia, I love yoga and Pilates, but feel inspired to try Andy's classes again, which means to try Tai Chi. Very quickly, in 15 seconds, three lines or three words on how to get through the rough and tumble of life as we think, I can't face this anymore. What do we do?
Yeah, find that joy. Find a younger person that you can get to know and, you know, so they don't die before you. And just give back. Give to others. Give to children. Give to your family. Give to people out in the community. And you will truly find that joy that lets you get through all of the tough times of growing older.
Give, give, give. And do Tai Chi. Time's Wing Chariot attacks us. Thank you for a brilliant audience for guessing those things. I think we have Jean Joyce and Anna are going to get your books. Until next week, next week with Lucinda when Lucinda is back. Stay safe, stay curious, stay generous, love the gift of aging, and of course, stay Goldsters. Tell friends, enemies, and families what a great time we have. We are now all Tai Chi fans. Thank you to our very special guest for sharing your stories and taking us into this strange world, this elderly world that we should all know more about and prepare for. Dr. Elizabeth Ekstrom, for being such a fantastic human being and guest. Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Humphrey. Great to be with you today. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.